Okay, so we are in, it's been a while since we last met. We are in Numbers 25. We just finished the Balaam section last time we met, Numbers 24. So if you remember, we're starting 25. No, 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 we're going to do 25 and hopefully 26 today. No, that's all right. That's all right. So Numbers 22 to 24 was all about Balaam. So if you remember, Balak, king of Moab, hired Balaam to come curse Israel because he knew he could not defeat Israel in battle unless he could get Israel's God to turn against Israel. And Balaam learned the hard way that he's only allowed to say what God allows him to say. It took his donkey talking to him to get him to really understand that. And then he proceeded to make Balak really, really angry because all he would do was bless Israel, bless Israel, bless Israel. And then in the end, he ended up cursing Moab. And he always came back to, I'm only allowed to say what God lets me say. I'm only allowed to say what God lets me say. Okay. But from chapter 24 to 25, there is really no link. But if we remember, in chapter 31, verse 16, it says that chapter 25, what the Moabite women and the Midianite women did was Balaam's idea. Okay, so let's go there. Chapter Numbers 31. Just to remember. Verse 16. I'll read verse 15. This is when, chapter 31 is when Israel fights the Midianites. In verse 15, Moses is talking, and Moses said to them, "Have you spared all the women, the Midianite women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor." So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord. Okay, so the Midianite women, and we can thus safely assume also the Moabite women, because both of them were involved in chapter 25, come to seduce the men of Israel, and it was Balaam's idea. It was through his counsel. Okay, so Balaam, we talked about it over and over again in chapters 22 to 24. Balaam could not get God to turn against Israel. So then his bright idea, which actually was a good idea to accomplish what Balak wanted him to accomplish, was to get Israel to turn against God. Okay, and when Israel rebels against God, then they get punished. Okay, so it's kind of accomplishes the same thing, just in a different way. Okay, this is going to be the final judgment on Israel before they enter the promised land. Okay, and this is also going to eliminate whatever is left of the first generation. We don't know how many were left by this point. Presumably not very many. Okay, but any who were left would have been eliminated in this plague that happens here. Okay, this chapter is a tragedy. It's national apostasy. Okay, because Israel turns against God and starts worshiping another god. Okay, and it's just so ironic. I mean, this is very similar to chapter 32, right? So after all these wonderful blessings that God has given through Balaam, Israel rebels. Okay, just like in Exodus, God is on the mountain giving the covenant to Moses, and Israel is down the mountain building a golden calf. Okay. In both the accounts, this one, chapter 25, and in Exodus 32, the Levites are going to distinguish themselves. In Exodus 32, it's the Levites as a whole. Here, it's going to be specifically Phinehas. And the people didn't necessarily know what was going on with God. So with Moses on Sinai, right? One of the reasons they rebel is they tell Aaron, we don't know what's happened to Moses. He's never going to come back, right? We don't know what's going on. And then they weren't privy at this point to what Balaam had said, like everything that was going on between Balak and Balaam and God. Okay, they wouldn't have necessarily known that until later. So they don't know what God has done, okay? But God is holy. He does not allow idolatry, okay? So he's going to wipe out a bunch of them. And this is going to be a warning to the second generation. This is what happens when you dabble in idolatry. And if you know Israel's history at all, they struggle with idolatry until the exile. Okay, so from now until the north gets taken over by Assyria and the south gets taken over by Babylon. Okay, so can someone read for me chapter 25, verses 1 through 9?
While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. These invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before the Lord, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." And Moses said to the judges of Israel, "Each of you kill those of his men who have yoked themselves to Baal of Peor." And behold, one of the people of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman to his family in the sight of Moses and in the sight of the whole congregation of the people of Israel, while they were weeping in the entrance of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose and left the congregation and took a spear in his hand and went after the man of Israel into the chamber and pierced both of them, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. Thus the plague on the people of Israel was stopped. Nevertheless, those who died by the plague were 24,000.
Okay, so first they're at Shittim, which if you look on your map, forgot to pull it out. If you look on this 3-3 one, if you still have it, it's right here. It says Israel's camp next to the left of Amorites, King Sihon. Do you see that? It's right across the Jordan from Jericho. Jericho's over here. Okay, so this is where they're camped. And if you look down just a little south, this is Baal Peor with a question mark. So maybe that's where this was. Okay, so they're camped over here, right next to the Jordan River, and possibly not too far away is this Baal Peor. Okay, now there's a question mark there because we're not 100% sure where that is. But this is their last stop before they take over the Promised Land, before they start their conquest of the Promised Land. Okay, so their 40 years of wandering is finally over. Okay, if we go to Joshua... Can someone read for me Joshua 2, verse 1?
And Joshua the son of Nun sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." And they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there.
Okay, so the spying out of Jericho starts from here. Okay, so this is where they're camped at Shittim. So this is the last stop. Okay, they're poised, ready to enter the land. Now we still have the whole book of Deuteronomy, but the book of Deuteronomy doesn't take a lot of time, right? It's just a second telling of the law from Moses to the new generation, and then Moses dies, and then they're allowed to enter the land. Okay, so Deuteronomy doesn't take a lot of time. So they're about ready to enter the land, but they have one last lesson to learn. Okay, and this lesson becomes infamous and is mentioned throughout the Old Testament. Also, the worship of Baal is going to be a constant temptation for Israel once they're in the land. If you look at verses 1 and 2, it says the people three times. While Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot. Verse 2, for they invited the people, and the people bowed down. Okay, so it emphasizes their downfall. The people, Israel is doing this. They play the harlot. They offer sacrifice, or they're invited to the sacrifices, and that leads to them bowing down. Okay, play the harlot in the Hebrew is literally committed profanity by fornicating. Okay, so there is the adultery, but it's also profane against God. So this is literal fornication or harlotry, prostitution, and spiritual. Right? Because by doing this, they are rebelling against God. It's not just a physical act. It's a spiritual rebellion against God. Okay. Prostitution was part of Canaanite worship. This was part of their worship ceremonies. It was nothing for them. It was nothing uncommon. Okay. I said this is the gateway drug, right? It was through the prostitution that enticed. It was the women that enticed the men. And then it leads to bowing down. Okay, and we know for Solomon, right? What led to his downfall? His wives, all gajillion of them, thousand of them. Okay, so the women were the problem. So here too, the women come, and you can't get God to turn against Israel, so you just get the Israelite men to turn against their God. And how do you do that? Through women, right? People have not changed. It says daughters of Moab specifically in verse 1, but then if you look down in verse 6, it's a Midianite woman, okay? And if you remember all the way back to chapter 22, Moab and Midian have been allies in the hiring of Balaam, right, to come and curse Israel. So now it's both the Moabite women and the Midianite women that are involved in this, okay? So verse 2, the women invite the people, specifically it's going to be the men, right, to the sacrifices. And then these sacrifices would have been similar to the Israelite peace offering. If you remember, the peace offering was you would offer part of it, the priest would get part of it, and you got to eat part of it, right, you and your friends. So these sacrifices, it would have been a feast. So you would have offered some of it to the gods, right, but then you got to have a whole meal of meat and celebration, and prostitution would have come along with that as well. Okay, and through this, the men end up bowing down and worshiping the God that the meal was in celebration of. Okay, let's go to Exodus 34. Can someone read for me Exodus 34, verse 14 through 16?
With the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with their gods and sacrifice to their gods, and someone would invite you to eat of his sacrifice. And you might take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might play the harlot with their gods and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods.
Okay, so Israel has been warned of this, right? All the way back in Exodus at Sinai. And this is exactly what's happening. The women come along, and what do? They make the men take part in the sacrifices and bow down. And it's not like they're being forced to. The men are doing this willingly. Okay, verse 3, it says, so Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor. The ESV that Brittany read said yoked themselves, which is what it is literally. Okay, they are yoking themselves, joining themselves. A yoke, right, is on two oxen so that they go the same direction. Okay, so they are yoking themselves to another god. So now, obviously, they are going in a different direction than Yahweh is going. So this breaks the first two commandments. You shall have no gods before me and no idols. So how do you think God's going to respond to that? Not very well. It's going to be severe. The punishment will be severe. Okay, they yoke themselves to Baal of Peor. This is the first time that Baal is mentioned in the Bible, okay? He was a Canaanite fertility god, and he is going to be very tempting to Israel from now until the exile. If you remember Elijah and the prophets of Baal, right, on Mount Carmel. Okay, so Baal is going to stick around for all of Israel's history and be a very sore point. But here is when he first shows up. Okay, Israel was to be a nation set apart for Yahweh. And here they are joining a different God. Okay, and remember all that Yahweh has done for them. Okay, throughout providing for them manna, water, time and again. Okay, bringing them out of Egypt, giving them the promised land. The reason they're not already in the land is their own fault. Okay, God has done so much for them, and yet here they are joining to another God. So clearly God is going to be angry, right? end of verse 3, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Of course he is. Verse 4, the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. Okay, so God is furious. Atonement has to be made. How do you satisfy God's wrath against a nation? What does it say? Yes, hang them. Who?
The chiefs.
The leaders, Okay, you kill the leaders. Why? Do you remember?
Because they stand in place for the nation as a whole.
That's exactly right. Corporate solidarity, right, is the fancy word for the leader is responsible for the people. Okay, Brittany's version says hang them. Ours, NAS, just says execute them. This is either hang or impale. I don't know if you remember. It was years probably now ago that Kyle did a whole sermon on corporate solidarity and on the impalement of the kings. Okay, but the people, the leaders represent the people, so they are the ones to be killed in place of the people. Okay, this is a hanging or an impalement. This is the most severe and serious punishment. It is humiliating and shameful. Right, which is why the Jews could not believe that Jesus was the Messiah, because the Messiah would never allow himself, one, to die in the first place, and two, to die in such a humiliating and shameful way. Okay. And our version, NAS, says in broad daylight. Yours says before the sun, right, which is what it means. But this is a public display of God's justice. You are to be hung out to dry for all to see, right, as an example to others. Like, don't do this crime, right? Because you die a shameful death, you are hung out for all to see. This is the biggest shame, the worst way to die. Also, it says before Yahweh or before the Lord in verse 4. You're to execute them in broad daylight before the Lord. This is the only thing that will satisfy God's judgment. Because it says, so the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. God is setting up a precedent here. How do you satisfy God's wrath? You impale the leaders. Okay? And this is going to be the setup for Christ. Right? This starts the example of what Christ is ultimately going to do for us. Right? We are the ones that deserve to die, but Christ instead dies for us in the most humiliating, shameful way, but being impaled in broad daylight before Yahweh is how you satisfy God's wrath. Okay. Let's go to Deuteronomy 21. Can someone read for me verses 22 and 23? Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23.
And if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him the same day, for a hanged man is cursed by God. You shall not defile your land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance.
Okay, so a hanged man is cursed by God, right? Another reason the Jews could not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. Right? Because it seems like he is cursed. He is hung up on a tree for all the world to see. Okay? But here, God is saying this is the definitive solution for his wrath. Now, obviously, the leaders that get killed here, they're sinners too, right? So they are just a picture of Christ and what he's going to ultimately do, the perfect one dying in our place. But the pattern, the picture is set up here. How do you turn away God's wrath? The leader, somebody as a representative of the people, is hung on a tree for all the world to see. Okay. Verse 5, so Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Okay, so Moses then instructs the judges to kill the guilty, those who have worshipped. Okay. So the question is, and the commentators had a lot of opinions about this, who dies? Is it the leaders? Is it the guilty? You know, the people who've actually done the sinning, who dies? Some think that Moses disobeyed. God says kill the leaders. Moses is like, that's a little harsh. Why don't we just kill the people who sinned, right, instead of killing the leaders? Okay, but in this passage, there is no indication that Moses did what was wrong. And we know God is very clear when Moses sins, right? And he's called out. And Moses, even who wrote this book, he calls himself out when he sins, right? He records it exactly what he says. Okay, so there is no indication that Moses did what was wrong, okay, that he changed what God said. Notice, if you notice it, it says, slay his men who have enjoyed themselves to Baal of Peor, right? So the guilty are still going to die, but they are to be slayed. This is a different word in the Greek, in the Hebrew, than to impale or execute or hang, okay? So this is a different word. They just die. They don't necessarily have to be hung out for the world to see. Okay. God says specifically that if the leaders are impaled, his anger will turn away. And what's interesting is if you look down in verse 8, okay, this is Phinehas. He went after the man of Israel into the tent, pierced both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. So it is not until a man is impaled and we find out later that he is a leader, okay, that God's anger is turned away. Okay, so I'm not exactly sure who all died. Okay, we do know in verse 9, 24,000 die by plague. I don't know how many leaders were impaled, but it is not until a leader is impaled that things come to an end. Okay, so what God says is commanded, then no, we don't. We just know it kills people, right? Yeah. But Phinehas does exactly what God has said in verse 4, and that's when his anger is appeased. Verse 6 through 8, this is what Phinehas does. Okay, it says, then behold. Okay, this indicates a simultaneous action in the Hebrew. So it's basically right as Moses is telling the judges to kill the guilty, what happens? One of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman. Right? So right as Moses is telling the judges, hey, you need to go out and find those who are guilty and kill them. Right? A man brazenly brings a Midianite woman into the camp, okay? Now, Baal of Peor on your map, right, is in a different spot. Now, he is, instead of the sin now just being outside the camp, he is now bringing it inside the camp, not only inside the camp, but specifically to where? Yes. Because Moses and the congregation are weeping in the doorway of the tent of meeting. So this is right into the very center, into the very heart of the Israelite camp. It's blatant sin, not only in the sight of Israel, but into the very presence of God himself, right? Because it was the doorway of the tent of meeting where God reveals a lot or speaks or whatever. You know, this is the doorway to his house. If you look at verse 14, it says the slain man was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader, that's key, of a father's household among the Simeonites. Simeon, okay, so this is somebody from Simeon. Simeon was to camp on the south side of the tabernacle, okay? So if you remember, let's see if you can see this color. Okay, the doorway was here on the east. Okay, Simeon was here on the south somewhere, right? To be seen from the doorway to the tabernacle, you're not just sneaking into your tent, right? Because he could have just snuck around and come into his tent and done his business, right? And nobody would have maybe known, or it wouldn't have been as obvious. But to be seen, the people, or at least a bunch of them, are gathered here to mourn and weep because this is such a terrible tragedy. For somebody from Simeon to come and they all can see, this is on purpose. Okay, it's not, oops, I got caught. It's a, I'm going to do this in your face kind of thing. Okay. So this is spiritual and political treason, right? Israel was to be a nation set apart for God. They were not to marry somebody who was of another tribe or another nation unless they converted, right? We know Rahab we read about her just briefly today. She converts and becomes an Israelite and becomes in the line of Christ, right? She lived in Jericho. So that was fine. But if they're not going to convert, then you were to have nothing to do with them. Okay. Okay, so again, the immorality that was previously outside the camp has been brought into the very center of the camp. Remember, the tribes all camp around the tabernacle, so that he is coming to the very doorway of the, or at least to be seen from the doorway of the tabernacle. He's coming to the very center of the camp. Okay, so if you notice, it's in the sight of Moses, the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. So they are coming to beseech God, apologize, repent, right? And these people probably are ones that had nothing to do with any of this, right? But they're coming because they know God is going to be angry. Verse 7, when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest... Okay, so Phinehas is in line for the high priesthood, right? Because if you remember Aaron's high priest, it passes to, remember he had four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu are dead, killed by God. But he still has two more sons, Eleazar and Ithamar. Well, the high priesthood passes to Eleazar. Okay, so then it's going to pass to one of Eleazar's sons. So Phinehas is in line for the high priesthood. Because of his actions here, he becomes high priest for Joshua and for part of the book of Judges. Okay. In Numbers 31, he's going to lead the army against the Midianites. In Joshua 22, he is mentioned as arbitrating with the Transjordan tribes. There's a problem between Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe Manasseh, who live on the east side of the Jordan River with the rest of Israel that lives on the west side of the Jordan River. And Phinehas is the one who deals with that. And he also deals with the Benjamin issue in Judges when almost the entire tribe of Benjamin gets wiped out. Okay. So Moses issues his command, Judges, go kill the guilty people, right? While he is saying that, this man from Simeon is bringing a woman in to the very center of the camp, a Midianite woman. Okay, Phinehas sees the blatant, defiant sin and immediately he acts, right? When Phinehas, verse 7, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation. So he acts immediately. There's no hesitation. There's no consultation. There's no, is this really the right thing to do, right? He acts. He takes a spear. He went after the man of Israel into the tent. Okay, so he follows them right in. There is no, there's no privacy. There's no nothing. He doesn't care. You are blatantly sinning in the face of God, and I am going to blatantly bring you to justice right here, right now.
Does he mean into the tent of meeting, or
into
the guy's
tent? Into the guy's tent. Okay. He wasn't so brazen to actually enter. God would have just put him to cinders, I'm sure, if he'd done that. But no. So I don't know where his tent was. I mean, because you'd think his tent would be somewhere here, but maybe, I don't know. But they could see, or at least he brought him in and went down, whatever. They knew what he was going to do. Okay, so Phinehas follows him straight into his tent and impales the couple. Okay, so apparently they start to have sex almost immediately. Phinehas follows them in and he pierces them together with one spear, but through their stomach. NAS says the body. Brittany's ESV said the stomach, which body is literally the stomach. Okay, so Phinehas can stab them both together. Okay.
Yep.
And Phinehas was angry, right? I mean, this is somebody who is blatantly sinning in the very presence of God, and he does not care. I mean, this is bold as you can get, right? He's not off doing his business somewhere outside the camp in privacy. He is bringing this woman in so for all to see and be like, watch what I'm going to do, okay? And I dare you to do something about it. Well, Phinehas did something about it, okay? And it was because of this impalement, right? Second half of verse 8. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. Okay, so when Phinehas does this, God's wrath and the plague is stopped. Okay, this sets is a setup for the ultimate appeasement of God's wrath through the impalement of Christ. Okay, if we go to Zechariah, can someone read for me Zechariah 12, verse 10?
I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. And they will weep bitterly over him, like the bitter weeping over a firstborn.
Okay, so this is prophecy, right? Saying they will look on me whom they have pierced. And in the New Testament, right, we take this to be talking about Jesus, because he is hung on the tree and he is pierced through the side with a spear, right? They're Israel, Jerusalem, they're going to mourn because they're going to realize that they missed Messiah. Okay, that word for pierced, that's the same word that's used here in Numbers 25 when it says about Phinehas, he went after the man in Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through. Okay, same word. It's about, so this is setting up a picture of Christ. How is God's wrath appeased? Somebody is impaled on behalf of the nation. Now, obviously, this leader was a sinner, right? So you can't take the connection too far. But the idea is setting up for Christ, that God's wrath is appeased when through this shameful way of dying, okay, which it's going to be Christ. Okay, Phinehas's zeal and righteous anger saved many lives, right? Because it's not until he did this, it says then the plague was stopped. If he had not done this, if he had not acted immediately, who knows how many more people would have died. Okay, so even so, 24,000 die. Right? And this is going to include whoever of the first generation that is left. Who knows? This man might have been part of the first generation. We don't know. Okay. Questions, verse 1 through 9. Okay, can someone read for me verses 10 through 18?
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore I say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of the perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of the father's household among the Simeonites. The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was the head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor.
Okay. Verse 10, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, okay, this is a little harder to see in the English, but this is how God has spoken to Moses the whole book. Whenever God's revealing something to Moses, it says, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying, over and over and over again. Okay, except after chapter 20. Chapter 20 is when Moses strikes the rock instead of speaks to it. Okay, then if you look up in verse 4, it says, the Lord said to Moses. Or it can be translated in the English, the Lord spoke to Moses. Now, in the English, it doesn't look that different, okay? But in the Hebrew, the difference is more obvious. So it's like God has spoken, used a phrase of how he speaks to Moses this whole time until after he sins. And then it's a little more abrupt and he changes. Just the intro, the Lord spoke to Moses, or the Lord said to Moses, okay? Here in verse 10 is the first time it's returned back to what it was. And for the rest of the book, it will be this way. Okay, does that make sense? So God speaks to Moses a certain way. An intro. Then the Lord spoke to Moses saying. Okay, in the English, it's a little harder to see because we're like they're saying the same thing. Okay, then the Lord spoke to Moses saying. It's that way until he sins in chapter 20. Then when God speaks to Moses from 20, well, and he's not speaking to Moses in 22 to 24 because that's all about Balaam. But from chapter 20 to the first part of chapter 25, it just says the Lord said to Moses, or the Lord spoke to Moses. Do you see how it's different? It's just a little different.
So it's like the idea of being maybe more personal.
Yes.
Before chapter 20 and then a little
right.
bit more impersonal or
right.
you know.
Right.
Separate.
Right. Okay. Right. Yes. Thank you. And so now in verse 10, we have reverted back to what it was before. And so it's like God is saying, Moses, you sinned against me. Now there's a problem in our relationship. Okay. Then it's not until after this when Phinehas impales, right? So that's why another thing why I don't think Moses did what was wrong when he tells the judges to kill, right? He's not saying don't impale the leaders. And now verse 10, it seems like Moses is restored to full relationship with God again. Now that doesn't mean he gets to enter the promised land, right? He still has a consequence for his sin, but his relationship with God is restored. And so that's another indication in the Hebrew that what Moses did in this story, whatever part he played, even though in the first 9 verses it's not a lot, right? He did what was right, and he obeyed what God said. Okay? Verse 11, Phinehas the son of... Yes.
In our Bibles, if it...
Yeah. If you look at verse 4 in chapter 25, it just says the Lord said... So compare verse 4 and verse 10. The first little bit of verse 4. The Lord said to Moses. Verse 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses saying. Okay. It's not super different in the English. But in the Hebrew, you can tell it is. I mean, it is a little different. But the Hebrew, it's a little more obvious. Yeah. Okay. So verse 11. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. So Phinehas is praised and rewarded by God for his actions. He is a picture of what holiness and zeal for God looks like. Okay, he says jealous. He was jealous with my jealousy. This is the same word that's used in Numbers 5. If you remember, Numbers 5 was if a husband suspects his wife of adultery, right? And then that whole process where she has to go and drink the water that has the dirt from the tabernacle in it. And if she's guilty, her stomach will waste away, right? You remember all that? Well, it's if the husband is jealous, right? He thinks his wife has had an affair. This is the same word for jealous. Okay. Phinehas had God's jealousy to protect God's holiness. He was jealous for God, and he saw the blatant sin and was angry and acted immediately. Okay, God was ready to wipe out Israel to preserve his holiness, he says, so that I did not destroy, right? Because of Phinehas' actions, he did not destroy the sons of Israel. So Phinehas personified God's anger. So God's wrath was turned away. This was the job of a priest, was to represent God to the people. Okay. Verse 12, therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of a perpetual peace priesthood, because he was jealous for his God. Okay, covenant of peace means that God would be with him, work out for his good pleasure, safe dwelling, and abundant blessing. Okay, so he gets the covenant of peace and he gets the perpetual priesthood. This means what this, because he was already a priest, right? But this means that the high priesthood would now come through his line. Okay, so the high priesthood was going to be Aaron's line, but now it's going to always be specifically through Phinehas' descendants. Okay, what's interesting here is that if you remember the high priest... In 1 Samuel is Eli. Okay, remember, and Eli has the two sons that sleep with the women in the gate of the tabernacle, and they take the Ark of the Covenant to battle with the Philistines, and Eli falls over backward dead, right? Okay, so Eli's not a great guy. What's interesting to note, Eli is not a descendant of Phinehas. If we go to 1 Chronicles, if I can find it, 1 Chronicles 6, and I will read it because it's just going to be a bunch of names. Okay, but this is 1 Chronicles 6, verse 1 to 10. Okay, sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari, right? Sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uzal. Sons of Amram were Aaron, Moses, and Miriam. Sons of Aaron were Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Right now, here, verse 4. Eleazar became the father of Phinehas. Okay, so now we're going to get a line of high priests. Phinehas became the father of Abishua. Abishua, Buki, Buki, Uzi, Uzi, Zerahiah, whatever. Okay, Zerahiah became the father of Meriot. Meriot became the father of Amariah. Amariah became the father of Ahitub. Ahitub became the father of Zadok. Zadok became the father of Ahimaaz. Ahimaaz became the father of Azariah. Azariah became the father of Johanan. Johanan became the father of Azariah. Again, it was he who served as the priest in the house which Solomon built in Jerusalem. Okay, so by this point, we're at Solomon. Past, clearly past Samuel and past David. No Eli is mentioned in here. Okay, so if he was in the line of Phinehas, he should have been mentioned here because he would have been a high priest. So we know that Eli was not the rightful high priest, and so he had to be gotten rid of, which he was. And then this is also probably a reason why his sons turned out the way they did and he wasn't a great high priest, right? I mean, and it took him three times to realize that God was calling Samuel, right? Before he realized, oh, that's God talking to you, Samuel. You better go say something different. I don't know. I don't know, but that's during the time of the judges. Samuel is the final judge. So every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. I mean, Israel was a mess by that point. So it's not super surprising that they, I mean, and like we've said all through the laws, these are what God said they were to do. Whether Israel actually obeyed them or not is another question. Okay, but the perpetual priesthood is going to come through Phinehas. Why? Because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. Usually an animal sacrifice was used to make atonement, but here it is the just death of the sinners which makes atonement. Okay? The plague that Phinehas stopped was the final one that wiped out the first generation. Okay, Phinehas' zeal for God is going to be the zeal of the second generation. I've said it before, this second generation that enters the land, they are probably one of Israel's finest generations, if not the best generation. Okay. Verse 14 and 15 just give us the details of the man and woman involved. So here it is that we find out that it was Zimri, and he was a leader of the tribe of Simeon, and that the woman's name was Cozbi. Okay, and she was the daughter of Zur, who was also a leader in Midian. It says, a leader of a father's household Zur was the head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Okay, so it was a leader and a leader's daughter.
I'm surprised they even mentioned her name.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, and her name is mentioned again then in verse 18. Verse 16 to 18, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if you notice again, that's that old way, same as verse 10, 16 is same as verse 10. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, for they have been hostile to you with their tricks, with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. Okay, so the Midianites, remember, this wasn't just the Midianite women, it was the Moabite women as well. But the Midianites are singled out because it was a Midianite woman that came into the center of camp, okay, with the leader of Simeon. So they're singled out. And Israel, by command of God, was to be hostile to them. And they go to war with Midian in chapter 31. And that's after chapter 26. Chapter 26 is going to be the forming of a new army of the second generation. Okay, so once their army is formed, then in chapter 31, they go and fight Midian. And when Israel obeys this command of God to be hostile to the Midianites and strike them, right, then Balaam is also killed as well in chapter 31.
Back to
yes.
4 through
yes.
10. I'm surprised the Lord changes the way he spoke to Moses after Moses really didn't obey him regarding the leaders.
Okay, but I think he must have. So some people think he didn't obey. But there's nothing here that indicates that he didn't obey. Okay? So we only get what's recorded. We don't necessarily get everything that Moses said or that God says. Okay? God says impale the leaders. Moses says kill the guilty. Maybe God said both. Right? And Moses obeyed both. Maybe God was satisfied with the impalement of the guilty. That's why I said I'm not exactly sure who all died. But we do know that a leader was impaled, and that is what satisfied God's wrath, right? We also know that 24,000 other people died, right? Presumably, the guilty. God would have wiped out most of the guilty ones. And the judges might have gone out and done some slaying themselves of the guilty. But verse 10 seems to indicate that what Moses did was in line with what God said. He obeyed in this, so then there is a restoration of the relationship. Good. Any other questions?
I'm thinking that they mentioned the woman's name a couple times just because they wanted to make an example.
Right. Right.
Yeah, some woman died.
Right.
But they brought it in.
Right.
The other thing is, which they don't talk about, but it makes you wonder what in the world she was thinking.
Right.
That she would walk into camp in the presence of all these people, go with this man into the tent, knowing that she shouldn't even be there. Like, was she not fearing for her life? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it just seems very brazen.
Yeah.
And sinful, of course. And
right.
It's capitalizing on the fact that this was a huge sin in God's sight, and he was going to take care of it.
Right, but in her eyes, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal because prostitution was a normal part of Canaanite worship,
yeah, okay.
Right? And so the question is, how much did she know of the way Yahweh worked?
Yeah.
Which she might have known something, but Yahweh is obviously very different than all the other gods and all the other... all the gods she's grown up with, this was just part of what she did. So maybe, you know, maybe she wasn't even thinking she was in any danger at all. I don't know. Yeah. Right. 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 Yep.
But there's probably a lot of names in the Bible that, you know.
Well, there are a lot that are negative, yeah.
Negative.
Yeah.
Like King Saul.
Right. All right. Anything else? Questions? All right. So we are now at Numbers 26, and I don't know if you remember all the way back from the introduction, but Numbers is, the outline of Numbers is two censuses, well, I don't know, okay? So we had one in chapter 1 of the first generation, and now in chapter 26, oh, that's not going to work, we have the second one of the second generation, okay? So what I'm going to write for you, which you can copy or just look at it. You don't have to write it all down. But we're going to compare the first census to the second census, okay, per tribe. And then, okay. This is going to just take me a minute to write. This will really test your memory. I told you to pay attention to three tribes back in chapter one. Do you happen to remember what they were? Yeah. Nope. There are three tribes, especially today, that we are going to talk about. And at the beginning, I said we're going to need to remember these three tribes. I mean, it's not a big deal. It's going to be the tribes that, well, two of the tribes that change the most, and then the most important tribe. Okay, it's going to be, we're going to pay attention to Simeon, Judah, and Manasseh. Yeah, you don't have to. If you have a MacArthur Study Bible, it will have this column and this column and this column in your notes. So. Okay. All right, we're almost done. Okay, so these, okay, so Simeon, right, had 59,300 in the first census, 22,200, which is a decrease of 37,000. Okay, then Judah, right, he has 74,600, 76. Right, it's only an increase of about 2,000, but look at his numbers compared to everyone else's. And then we have Manasseh. They started out with 32,000. They end up with almost 53,000, which is an increase of 20,500. Okay, so those are the ones that we're going to highlight. And I know my lines aren't super straight. But. Okay, Numbers 26. We're not going to read this whole chapter because it's a lot of names. And it's 60-some verses long, 65 verses long. Okay.
How many verse five?
How many what?
How many verses?
First four verses.
Then it came about after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moses and to, is it Eleazar? Yeah. The son of Aaron, the priest, saying, take a census of all the congregation of the sons of Israel from 20 years old and upward by their father's households. Whoever is able to go out to war in Israel. So Moses and Eleazar, the priest, spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, take a census of the people from 20 years old and upward, as the Lord has commanded Moses. Now the sons of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt were...
Okay. So this is the end of the wilderness wanderings. The second generation is now in control. They are poised to enter the promised land. Okay, so this is... after the plague, verse 1, then it came about after the plague. Okay? It transitions from chapter 25 to 26. Now the first generation is entirely gone. Okay? So Israel can now try to enter the land again. This is going to be the same purpose as the first census, right? To count those available for military service. 20 years old and older. Okay, God had just commanded that Midian be dealt with. They go and strike at Midian. Well, they need an army to do that, and they need an army to conquer Canaan. Thus, chapter 27, let's see who's available for our army. 26, sorry. Thus, chapter 26, let's see who's available for our army. Okay, this is God's victory. He has raised up a holy people. Okay, the second generation is going to be Israel's best generation. Their first generation was probably one of Israel's worst. I don't know if you can say the worst because Israel had a lot of worse, bad generations. Okay, but the first generation, they were pretty miserable. They saw God work in mighty ways. And when they finally get to the promised land, they say, we don't want it. God says, fine, you're going to die. They say, just kidding, we'll take it. And so they die. And then when they're wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, they blame Moses. You didn't bring us into the promised land like you promised you would. Well, that was your own fault. Okay. But you can't remember. So he has raised up a holy people. God can refine and shape generations. Okay. This census also marks the nearing of the end for Moses. Of the first generation, he is the only one left that is still yet to die. And obviously Joshua and Caleb are left, but they are allowed to go into the promised land. Okay. So verses 5 to 51 is going to be the census. And we are not going to read all the names. But first, Reuben, verse 5. Reuben, Israel's firstborn. Okay. He is mentioned first. He is the eldest. This census differs from the first census in that clans are mentioned. Okay. Says the sons of Reuben, of Hanok, the family of the Hanukites, of Palu, the family of the Paluites. And you're going to see that for each son, each tribe of Israel, there's clans mentioned underneath them. Also, what's different about this census is that all the rebellions are mentioned, reminded. We talked about being famous for in a bad way. Well, they're all mentioned in this census. Because if you look at Reuben... verse 9, the sons of Eliab, Nemuel, and Dathan and Abiram. Do you remember them? These are the Dathan and Abiram who were called by the congregation who contended against Moses and against Aaron in the company of Korah when they contended against the Lord. So if you remember the rebellion of Korah, Korah was a Levite. Okay. Not only was he a Levite, he was from the tribe of Merari, the Kohathites, and they were the ones that carried the furniture, okay? They had the most important job. But he was joined by Dathan and Abiram, who were sons of Reuben, and their complaint was that Moses hadn't brought them to the promised land. They're the ones that couldn't remember that it was their own fault that they weren't in the promised land. Okay? But all the rebellions, all the sons that are involved in the rebellions are going to be mentioned, because this is going to be a warning again against this to the second generation. Remember what happened in the past. Remember history, right? Or you're doomed to repeat it. So we're going to remind you of what the history was and what the rebellion was. What's interesting is look at verse 11. Okay, it says, the sons of Korah, however, did not die. When we talked about the rebellion of Korah, we referenced this verse. Okay, these are going to be sons that did not side with their father. Okay, what's also interesting is that the sons of Korah wrote 10 different psalms. Okay, it'll say a psalm of the sons of Korah. The psalms are primarily about relying and trusting on God's grace and promises. Because this was their life story. This is what they had to do. Their dad was swallowed up when the earth opened, right? And so they had to trust in God. So they wrote 10 different psalms. Okay. Simeon is in verse 12 to 14. Okay. And the clans are mentioned, and then it says the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. This is a 37,000 person decrease. They go from 59,300 to 22,200. Why do you think Simeon decreased so much?
They sinned a lot.
Okay, specifically where? What did we just read?
Sure.
Yep. Peor, who was the main one in the Peor debacle? Simeon. Okay? So, possibly, we don't know this for sure, but maybe a big chunk of that decreased had just died, right? Had just been wiped out by the plague, right? 24,000 died. Who knows if most of that 24,000 came from this? We don't know, right? The Bible doesn't say. But Simeon decreases because Simeon was a leader in leading the nation into national apostasy against God. So God says, you're going to do that, you're not going to prosper. Your clan is going to go way down. Okay. Then we get Gad, which there's nothing super exciting about him. Next is Judah. Okay, verse 19 to 22 talks about Judah. Okay, Judah remains dominant. They started with 74,600. They now have 76,500, which is not really a huge increase, almost 2,000 people. But compared to everyone else, they're still the largest, right? Because this is the royal tribe. The kings are going to come from this tribe, and Messiah is going to come from this tribe. Okay, but Judah's not all good. We're reminded of the evil that's in Judah as well, okay? Verse 19, the sons of Judah were Ur and Onan, but Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan. Okay, do we remember the story of Ur and Onan? Let's go to Genesis 38. Can someone read for me verse 1 to 10? Genesis 38, verses 1 to 10.
There a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Chezib that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife to perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother. Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also.
Okay, so this is Judah, right, from the tribe of Judah. His oldest two sons, God just kills. We don't know what Ur did, but whatever he did, it was bad enough that God just killed him. Then Onan wouldn't do what he was supposed to do, which was to have a baby with his brother's wife, and then that presumably son would be would be from Ur's line. It would be treated as if it was the brother who died. That's how the culture worked, and that's what you were supposed to do. He wouldn't do it. He was selfish. He didn't want to raise a son for his brother, so God kills him as well. Okay? So this is a reminder of God's judgment on the disobedient. Now, the wife that he took for Ur was Tamar, right? Which, you remember, he gives her Onan, and he doesn't do his duty, and so God kills him as well. Well, then Judah doesn't want to lose his third son, Shelah. So he says, I'll give you Shelah when he gets older. Well, he has no intention of giving her Shelah because he's afraid that Shelah's going to die as well. So Tamar, if you remember, dresses up like a prostitute. Judah goes into her, and she gets pregnant, with twins. Okay, Judah's about ready to kill her because it seems like she's been unfaithful, but she took Judah's signet ring and staff and says, I'm pregnant by the owner of these, and Judah realizes it's him. Okay, what's interesting about this soap opera, right, is Perez and Zerah are the twins that Tamar has. Perez is in the line of Christ. Okay, Perez is then an ancestor of Boaz. It's in Ruth 4, end of Ruth 4. It lists their genealogy, at least through David, Jesse and David. Okay, so through that drama, we get Perez and Zerah, and Perez is going to be in the line of Christ. Okay, all right, we're going to skip to Manasseh, verses 28 to 34. Okay, if you look at Manasseh, they go from 32,200 to 52,700, which is an increase of 20,500. This is a 64% increase. Okay? The question is why? Why in the world does Manasseh increase so much? And the answer is actually not until chapter 27. But if you look at these verses, what's interesting is the beginning. It just lists all the different clans, okay? Verse 32, second half, and of Hepher, the family of the Hepherites. Verse 33, now Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, had no sons but only daughters. And the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. Okay, the names of women in a military census doesn't make much sense. Okay, but we meet the daughters of Zelophehad again in chapter 27, and they pose to Moses an inheritance question, right? Their father, Zelophehad, had only daughters, no sons, and he is dead as well. So So the daughters are concerned. We're not going to get an inheritance in the land. Our father's line is going to basically die out, right? It's going to be as if our father got no inheritance because we're women. There's no son. There's nobody to take the inheritance. Our inheritance is going to be lost. Okay. What's interesting about that is the first generation. What were they concerned about when they got to the land?
That they were going to be killed.
There were giants in the land. We're going to die. We should have just gone back to Egypt and died there. Like, why'd you bring us here to die? Okay. Now, what are they concerned about?
Having a name there.
Right. There's no question of whether we're going to conquer the land anymore. The daughters of Zelophehad are basically saying it's as if we've already conquered the land. The land's already ours. God has promised it to us, and we want our share. And what's crazy is Moses then lets women, God lets women inherit, which would have been unheard of, right, during this time. But it is because of the faith and the zeal of Zelophehad's daughters, right, that Manasseh increases, okay? Because this is the second generation. They have more faith. They have more passion. They are claiming God's promise. We know God is going to fulfill his promise. And we want our share of God's promise. And it's not fair that just because our dad didn't have any boys that we don't get our portion. Right? And so we'll study it in chapter 27. But they're then supposed to marry within the tribe and not. Because if they marry outside the tribe, then their land is now going to become another tribe. So they are allowed to inherit and keep the land in the tribe. so that their land stays in the tribe of Manasseh.
Where is that, 27?
Yeah. It's going to be in 27, verses 1 to 14. We'll study it next time. But it talks about it. And it's also going to talk about it in chapter 36 as well. Same idea. Okay. All right. So then we're going to skip all the way down to verse 51. The total, right, is 601,730. This is not very different. Right? It's only a net decrease of 1,820 people. Okay? So basically the same. God has been faithful. He has protected Israel during the wilderness wanderings. Okay, despite all the judgments and the complainings and the rebellions, God has raised up a new generation to replace the old generation. Okay? That's going to conquer the land. Okay? Questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
About 28.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, so why isn't Joseph listed?
Great, because who's listed?
Yeah.
And who's not listed besides Joseph? Who else is not listed?
Levi.
Why? Because
they don't have land.
Because they don't inherit and they don't fight. The Levites are not part of the army. So Joseph is basically blessed for his faithfulness, but now he really has two tribes. So really, it's like there's 13 tribes of Israel, but there's kind of always 12. You always talk about 12. The Levites are, and they're small. The Levites are also very small. They're even going to be smaller than Simeon, because Simeon has 22,200, but these are fighting age men, 20 and older. At the end of this chapter, we're going to see the Levites. They have 23,000, but that's from 1 month old and older males. Okay, so that's like all their males is only 23,000. Simeon has 22,000, but that's 20 years old and older. So Levites are always small, but they're going to be the priests and serving the tabernacle.
So if you're naming the 12 tribes of Israel, you would include Levi and Joseph, and you would not.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Because of
right. And sometimes you hear Manasseh and Ephraim referred to as the half tribe Manasseh, the half tribe
right.
Ephraim. Okay. Any other questions?
So then 27, if you're saying it was because of their faithfulness that their tribe was increased for Manasseh, 27 actually would take place before the census?
Not necessarily, because it says then.
Yeah, that's true.
God is going to increase them because he knows of their faithfulness. It's just in scripture, that's the only reason really. And it's not blatantly said, this is the reason Manasseh increases, but it's mentioned right after, and it's the tribe of Manasseh is where they're from. Good question. Anything else? Okay, can someone read for me verses 52 to 56?
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, among these the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to their number of names. To the larger group you shall increase their inheritance, and to the smaller group you shall diminish their inheritance. Each shall be given their inheritance according to those who were numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot. They shall receive their inheritance according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to the selection by lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller group.
Okay, so here we find out this census is not just for the military, but it's for dividing up the land. Okay? So depending on these now new numbers, this is how the land's going to be divided up. So it means Judah's going to get the largest portion and Simeon's going to get the least amount of land. Okay, so it was to be divided up so that the larger tribes got a bigger portion of land and the smaller tribes got a smaller portion of land. And this is for all generations, future generations, right? So sad for Simeon, right? You got basically wiped out, and now you're going to have the smallest part. Abner said that basically Simeon almost disappears and gets subsumed into Judah, because I think their inheritance is like part of Judah, if I remember correctly. I don't have a map right now. It might be in Joshua. But I can't remember. But he said that, and I didn't take the time to look into it to see.
I mean, here, it's as if they're one.
Right, right, Simeon and Judah. And I think, yeah, I have the same. But I think they just got basically a chunk out of Judah's land because they're so small. Okay, the land was then also to be divided by casting lots. Okay, so this was their way of basically letting God assign the land, because it was believed when you cast lots, right, God is the one that determines what the outcome will be. So in Joshua, this is done. I think it's Joshua 15 and following, something like that. They actually divide up the land and cast lots to divide up the land. All right, then we have 57 to 65, which we're not going to read, but this is the census of the Levites. This also happened at the beginning. I think it's in chapter 3. Now it's all in the same chapter, but it's still a separate census, okay? Because the Levites are not part of the army. They're not part of the military, so they are counted separately. Okay, also in this, in verse 58, 59, 60, we're given the lineage of Moses and Aaron and Miriam. Okay, so they are the children of Amram and Jochebed. Jochebed was also a descendant of Levi. So they're the Levites, and both husband and wife are from the tribe of Levi. Okay, so it's a pure line. So this is part of the reason that they are in authority. Okay, also we're reminded, verse 61, of Nadab and Abihu. Okay, so they die in Leviticus 10 because they offered strange fire before the Lord. Okay, so again, it's a reminder that you worship God the way God commands you to worship him. You don't get to do things your own way. Verse 62, those who are numbered were 23,000. In the first census, it was 22,000, so they've increased 1,000. And then verse 63 to 65, these are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these, there was not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. And not a man was left of them except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Okay, 40 years. Complete turnover of population. Everybody 20 years old and older who was counted in that first generation is dead. Okay, except for Caleb and Joshua. They're the only exceptions. Which made me think, this is a very young nation. The oldest male, besides Caleb and Joshua, is 59. So they're between 20 and 59, there's 602,000 of them. Okay, this is a very young nation going to conquer the land, right? Because any other people group, right, have their older people, you know, all the way down to babies. This is 59 and younger, except for Caleb and Joshua. So this is a very young generation coming in to take over the land. But God has kept his promise of judgment, right? That everybody would die except for the two that were faithful. The only first generation person left that has yet to die is Moses. And he will die at the end of Deuteronomy. So God is faithful and he keeps his promises of judgment as well. But this is the new generation that God has raised up to come into the land. Questions, Numbers 26.